Chapter 10.
Alistair Ashcroft had seen the news. "An incident," they said. "Police have not yet released the details." Well, well. On top of that death in the car park, Pal Jackman would be a busy man. He bared his perfect teeth in a vulpine smile. Poor old Jackman. He looked out of his window. Below, a group of children were playing tag. He could hear their squeals of laughter. He wondered what it must be like to play games like that. The games he remembered from his own childhood hadn't been a great deal of fun. He shook his head. He disliked thinking about the past, although there were times when the memories came creeping back of their own accord. He turned away from the window. The present was so much more enjoyable. It was a new day, and he had a lot to do. First, a substantial breakfast, and he knew exactly where to get one. He had people around him now, people who cared about him. This man they thought they knew. He was liked and respected. Things were going well, for Alistair Ashcroft, at least. Pigs. 6 of them, to be precise. Why, wondered Robbie, when there'd been 2 fatal shootings, did he keep thinking about Farmer Beaton's missing pigs? He sensed it was significant somehow, but he couldn't for the life of him think why. His desk phone rang.
Detective Melton, it's Frank Beaton. I did like you said and spread the word to my friends and the other farms around. I was told there's been another animal theft, this time it were a stallion.
What, a horse? Robbie said, rather densely.
Where from, sir?
Appleyard Farm Stables, just outside Ferndyke Village. Belongs to a Mr. Clare Bullimore, and he is well pissed off, I can tell you. Besides being his breast-breeding stallion, it's his favourite, too.
When was this, Mr. Beaton?
Last night. He's not sure what time, exactly.
Can you let me have his number, sir? I'll try and get hold of him as soon as I can. But we are snowed under at present.
Ah, yes, I heard the news. Bad business, that. But...
Robbie understood. It's still a serious theft, sir, and it will be dealt with, I promise you. He scribbled down the number in his notebook. Thanks, Mr. Beaton. Robbie wondered what Jackman would say. Most likely Uniform would pay a call, give the owner an incident number, and it would be shoved on the back burner. Robbie wondered what a breeding horse would cost. Thousands? He really had no idea. Marie hurried into the office.
Success. Positive ID for Barney.
She went to the whiteboard and wrote the name Arthur James Barnes next to the post-mortem photograph of their latest victim.
Excellent, said Robbie. Don't often get that lucky so soon.
He looked towards the door. Is the boss with you?
In his office,
she grinned at him. I think I deserve a coffee. Want one? He shook his head.
No, thanks, Marie. I need a word with Jackman.
He went over and tapped on Jackman's door.
Sorry to bother you, sir, but there's been a horse theft reported.
Jackman's head snapped up.
Where from?
Appleyard Farm, Ferndyke Village.
Clay Bullimore's place.
He's a friend of my mother's. He has a breeding stable there. Nice bloke.
Great horses.
What happened?
One stallion stolen, sir.
What would you like me to do about it?
Go and see him, of course. Do it now. We've got a lot on today.
Jackman practically shoved him out of the office.
And tell him we'll do all we can to get it back. Oh, and Robbie, I want to know the horse's name, okay?
Outside the office, Robbie stood and stared back at the closed door in bewilderment.
You have the look of a startled gazelle, Robbie.
Marie came up behind him with a coffee in either hand.
The boss, he...
Oh, that, yeah. Caught me unawares, too. Well, don't worry too much. I don't think he's on anything. His pupils aren't dilated.
Robbie gawped at her.
I had considered the possibility of a changeling, but that usually applies to babies. He saw the merriment in her eyes, but wasn't quite sure how to respond.
I think I'd better go and do as I was told.
And that is? She asked.
Catch me some rustlers.
Bye.
After daily orders, Kevin Stoner went to look for William. He wanted to know if he and the others who had been with him the previous night were all right. He found William in a small cafe tucked away down a back alley in Salton Town. He sat alone, staring into an untouched cup of coffee.
"You eaten?" Kevin asked softly.
William shook his head slowly. Kevin went to the counter and ordered 2 bacon butties, a Danish, and 2 coffees. Kevin took the drinks and the pastry back to the table.
"I was worried about you and the others. That was a terrible thing to happen. It really shook me up. So I guess you guys are feeling the same."
William finally looked up.
"I've been on the streets a long time, Kev, but I've never seen anything like that. You'd have thought we were in Afghanistan, not Salton, the way that sniper took him out. Just for one horrible moment, I thought I was back in Northern..."
He stopped abruptly. The realization suddenly struck Kevin. He knew absolutely nothing about William's past. He had no idea why or how he'd become homeless, who he really was, and even where he came from. Asking had always seemed like an invasion of privacy. So, William was ex-military, just like Barney had been. He looked up as a young waitress placed their food on the table.
"Ketchup or brown sauce?"
She sounded Eastern European.
"Brown sauce, please," Kevin said.
William nodded.
"Same for me."
Kevin waited until the sauce was on the table before continuing.
"We have a name for him, William, so at least he won't finish up as a John Doe in the mortuary. His name was Arthur, and I'm told he was ex-SBS.
William sat up straight.
"No shit. Those guys are tough cookies."
Kevin wasn't going to mention the gun, but he did pose a question.
"So, why would one of those tough cookies be so scared at being on the streets?"
William gave him a somewhat patronizing smile.
"Think about it, Kev. He was off his meds, wasn't he? Now you tell me he's a veteran, well, neurosis, most likely. I've seen battle fatigue reduce a seasoned fighting machine to a gibbering wreck, crying like a baby and frightened of the dark."
He doused his sandwich in brown sauce and chewed contentedly. Kevin watched him eat. That butty, for which he'd paid some insignificant amount, was making a big difference to William's whole day. Then he told himself not to feel guilty. It was William's choice to live this way. William had told him it was preferable to the life he'd left behind.
"You and the others disappeared pretty fast last night," Kevin said.
"Doesn't do for us street dwellers to hang around when the police are about to turn up. No disrespect to you, Kev, but some of your lot aren't exactly sweetness and light where the homeless are concerned."
He took a gulp of coffee.
"Something bad happens, and no one to pin it on, and it's, oh, this guy's a homeless drunk, he'll do, stick it on him."
Kevin couldn't argue with this. He'd seen how some of his colleagues behaved towards the homeless. He stared at his half-eaten sandwich. William had consumed his and was now eyeing the pastry. He pushed his own plate and the pastry towards him.
"Go on, you have this. I've got to get back."
William didn't hesitate. He grabbed the pastry, saying,
"Before you go, last night you asked about the oil theft, didn't you? I couldn't sleep after what happened, so I spoke to a few people. Do you know a family called Lorimer?"
"Doesn't ring a bell."
"Should it?"
Kevin asked.
"They're not villains, so you might not have had call to meet them, but they are..."
William tapped his temple.
"A bit balmy. Unorthodox, like."
He lowered his voice.
"You know what happens with old Fenland families. Cousins marry cousins."
He raised an eyebrow.
"Let's say you probably won't see any of them on Mastermind."
Kevin took out his notebook and scribbled down the name.
"You don't know where they live, do you?" "Somewhere over Hawker's Fenway. They have an old run-down small holding. They're sort of self-sufficient, or so I'm told. And it's them who are responsible for the bodged theft." "No idea. Might pay to look in their direction."
William looked innocently at him.
"But you never heard it from me."
Kevin closed his notebook.
"Thanks, William.
He took a fiver from his pocket. If he turns out to be a viable lead, I'll add another. He stood up and pushed his chair back. It's unlikely you will, but if you hear anything at all about the shootings, will you ring me?
No, I can do, mate.
Kevin started to protest, then realised.
Ah, what an idiot. A mobile wouldn't last 5 minutes on the streets, would it? Dead right. Kids have been killed for their phones. I can get a message to you, though. But as you say, that kind of shit is serious stuff, and I'm not likely to hear too much about it.
William wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
Appreciate the breakfast, Kev. See you around.
On his way back through the town, Kevin thought about inbreeding. Surely it doesn't still go on today. He'd come across a few old Lincolnshire people who had told him that prior to the Second World War, they had lived in isolated villages with no transport services. They had no cars back then, so where did you go to meet a likely spouse? As far as a bicycle or horse ride would take you. And what happened when the neighbouring families were all spoken for? What then? Cousins married cousins. It was a different world now, of course. But in some lonely backwater hamlets, the legacy lingered, and you could see the results in the children. Kevin was eager to see the Lorimers for himself, but it was Charlie Button's case. He'd give the kid the tip-off, let him take the credit, but he'd ask Charlie if he could go along too. Rosie Cohen had spent the last 2 hours trying to find details of military personnel who'd been relieved of their duties due to stress or disability. It had not been easy. No one had been prepared to talk to her. Doctors declared themselves unable to discuss the people under their care, so she kept hitting brick walls. Luckily for her, one or two had engaged in antisocial behaviour that had brought them to public notice. 2 men and 1 woman, to be specific, had presented serious cause for concern in recent years. She had copies of the records of these 3 possibles and read them through again. They were Jeremy Freeman, former Marine, Lewis Smith, ex-Army rifleman, and Bethany Gadd, one-time police officer. All had been expert marksmen. All were damaged in some way. Now she could hand the records to Jackman for him to deal with. Thank God that was done. It was hard to concentrate when she had come to work this morning, leaving Tim and Jessica, her beloved twins, with ear infections. The symptoms were relatively mild, so Max was keeping an eye on them. She didn't need to worry. Max had gone from being a nervous wreck to super dad, almost overnight, and had thrown himself wholeheartedly into the task of parenthood. This was helped by the fact that he had a magic touch with a crying baby, and in fact was much better at it than she was. Still, it was a constant struggle to balance policing and parenting. When they were at work, they wanted to be at home with the twins and vice versa. Here, too, Max seemed to do better than she did. It wasn't helping that they now had a sniper on the loose, as well as the sinister figure of Alistair Ashcroft waiting to strike. Rosie yawned. It was all a bit too much. Marie and Gary were busy investigating the married life of Arthur James Barnes, an elite naval commando who had once lived according to the motto, by strength and guile. Gary knew a great deal more about the special boat service than her, and Marie had learnt that apart from their extraordinary prowess as swimmers, divers and canoeists, they were highly skilled at engaging in underwater demolitions and maritime counter-terrorism. "He deserves a proper investigation," stated Gary. "No matter what we dig up, the mere thought of a man like that being on the streets and scared is simply unthinkable." Privately, Marie wondered how many others were in the same state. Not everyone received the level of care that they deserved, even if they were heroes. Even so, she agreed with Gary. She handed him a sheet of paper. "That's all I know so far. You see what you can find out about the wife herself. I'll run a check on the report of domestic violence and see if the police were involved." It didn't take Marie long to discover that they had been called on several occasions. Each time, no one was prepared to press charges, so no further police action was taken. She noticed a comment made by one of the attending uniformed constables that the domestic setup seemed a bit odd. In her opinion, the wife seemed more like the aggressor than the husband. Marie read the name of the officer concerned and remembered that she had seen her at the crime scene of the shooting the night before. Marie rang down to the back office. Luckily, PC Hazel Stewart was on shift that morning, out in the yard cleaning her vehicle. Marie headed off to find her. Hazel thought for a while.
Yeah, I do remember her. Very weird, that particular shout. I actually got the feeling that it had all been staged, you know, like play acting.
She paused, frowning.
All except the husband. And I got the feeling he was on something. He seemed spaced out. He definitely didn't come across as if he'd just behaved as aggressively as the wife and her friend had said he did.
Her friend?
Yeah, this other woman was there, and giving it plenty of mouth, too.
Hazel pulled a face.
Between the two of them, I finished up feeling quite sorry for Arthur Barnes. He looked more like the victim than the wife.
That's interesting, said Marie. A close friend of his said he wasn't the type to go in for that kind of violence.
As I said, it all looked like a setup and no one wanted to take things further, so we just walked away in the end.
Puzzled me, though. Hazel wrung out the cloth she'd been using and hung it over the side of the bucket.
I was shocked to hear he'd finished up on the streets and then got murdered like that. I can only think it had something to do with drugs. I did think he was on something when we went to his house.
He was ex-military, so maybe after coming out of the services he'd just never settled, suggested Marie.
Why don't you talk to Kevin Stoner about that, Sarge? He's been talking to a snout about Barnes.
She found Kevin by the vending machine, muttering threats and curses.
Bloody thing, he's just swallowed another pound coin. It should have an Asbo slapped on it.
Marie walked round the machine and gave it a hefty thump. There was an immediate whirring noise, and a small handful of cash and a chocolate bar fell into the drawer. Kevin looked at her in awe.
Respect, Sarge, nice one.
She smiled sweetly at him.
In return, you can fill me in on what your snout told you about Arthur Barnes.
Snout?
Oh, you mean William? Well, not much, other than his thoughts on why he might be on the streets and in the state he was.
And that was what?
Well, Sarge, like a lot of veterans, especially injured or traumatised ones, they finish up on serious medication. He was pretty certain that Barney was off his meds and suffering from paranoia. That would account for his excessive fear and his belief that he was being threatened.
Very true. Except for the fact that someone really was out to kill him, and they succeeded.
Good point, Kevin sighed. But I'll bet meds show up in the post-mortem.
He pocketed his change.
Is Charlie Button in the CID room, Sarge?
He was when I left.
Then I'll come back with you if you don't mind. I'd like a word with him.
Kevin fell into step with her.
I wonder what we are looking at with these shootings. This sniper doesn't seem like anything I've read about in old cases. Shootings are usually mayhem, aren't they, Sarge? Mass killings or else a clear target, as in the assassination of a spy.
Marie nodded.
I agree. We can't think of anything that might link Christopher Keyes and Arthur Barnes, other than being shot in the head by our sniper.
For a moment, Kevin's step faltered.
Sorry, Kev, that was really thoughtless of me. I've not even asked how you are today. What a callous cow I am. My mother would give me hell.
Kevin laughed.
I'm good, honestly. It was simply shock.
And that's wearing off all the time.
Charlie's over at the photocopier.
Marie pointed across the office. See you later. Marie watched him go. It was going to be no bad thing to have Kevin Stoner as part of their CID complement.
Sarge, got a minute?
Gary called to her. She went over to his desk, pulled up a spare chair and sat down.
What have you got?
Quite a bit of hearsay and a load of supposition, but beneath all the smoke and mirrors, I think Brenda Barnes was having an affair and was using her new lover's sister to back up her allegation that Arthur was violent towards her. Gary stared at his screen.
I reckon she drove Arthur out just so that she could be with her new man.
Poor sod. And after all he went through, he had no luck at all, did he?
She paused.
Hang on. Where did you get all that from, Gary? Sounds more like Coronation Street than the police national computer.
My sister's best friend, Julie, still lives a few doors away from the Barnes house. I rang her and got the lowdown from the neighbours. Neat, huh?
Very.
So can you tell me what he did to get assassinated?
Gary looked apologetic.
Sorry, neighbourhood watch doesn't go that far.
Marie leaned back in her chair. You know something? I think we're wasting our time. I'm beginning to wonder if the victims are just red herrings to keep us occupied when we should really be looking for the shooter.
Rose is on that, said Gary. She's checking out sharpshooters who have been decommissioned because of mental health problems.
Well, I don't envy her. The military are notoriously tight-lipped when it comes to discussing their failures. But maybe that's another red herring. My money's on the gun club.
You could be right, Gary said.
Uniform are on the ground, gathering up names and taking statements from members. They were onto it immediately after you had your visit from Mr. Harcourt. They've promised to flag up anything of interest.
Keep an eye on that, Gary. Anything even the slightest bit interesting, and we'll go ourselves, okay?
Gary nodded.
I'll keep you updated.
Marie stood up.
Just going to check in with the boss.
She stopped and added,
Have you spoken to him this morning, Gary?
Not yet. Why?
Oh, nothing. Just wondered.